currently turning to follow me, were tagalongs, people who spent most of their time trying to tail prominent gunters and gather intel on their movements so they could sell the information later. I was always able to lose these idiots by jumping to light speed. A lucky thing for them. If I couldn't lose someone who was trying to tail me, I usually had no choice but to stop and kill them. As the Vonnegut made the jump to light speed, each of the planets on my view screen became a long streak of light. Light speed engaged, Captain, Max reported. ETA to arcade is estimated at 53 minutes. 15 if you want to use the nearest Stargate. Stargates were strategically located throughout each sector. They were really just giant spaceship-sized teleporters. But since they charged by the mass of your ship and the distance you wanted to travel, they were normally used only by corporations or extremely wealthy avatars with credits to burn. I was neither. But under the circumstances, I was willing to splurge a little. Let's take the Stargate, Max. We're in kind of a hurry. Chapter 22. The Vonnegut dropped out of light speed, and arcade suddenly filled the cockpit view screen. It stood out from the other planets in the area because it wasn't coded to look real. All of the neighboring planets were perfectly rendered, with clouds, continents, or impact craters covering their curved surfaces. But Arcade had none of these features, because it was home to the Oasis's largest classic video game museum, and its appearance had been designed as a tribute to the vector graphic games of the late 70s and early 80s. The planet's only surface feature was a web of glowing green dots similar to the ground lights on an airport runway. They were spaced evenly across the globe in a perfect grid, so that, from orbit, Arcade resembled the vector graphic Death Star from Atari's 1983 Star Wars arcade game. As Max piloted the Vonnegut down to the surface, I prepared for the possibility of combat by charging up my armor and buffing my avatar with several potions and nanopacks. Arcade was both a PvP zone and a chaos zone, which meant that both magic and technology functioned here. So I made sure to load up all of my combat contingency macros. The Vonnegut's perfectly rendered steel loading ramp lowered to the ground, standing out in sharp contrast against the digital blackness of Arcade's surface. As I stepped off the ramp, I tapped a keypad on my right wrist. The ramp retracted, and there was a sharp hum as the ship's security system activated. A transparent blue shield appeared around the Vonnegut's hull. I gazed around at the horizon, which was just a jagged green vector line denoting mountainous terrain. Here, on the surface, Arcade looked exactly like the environment of the 1981 game Battle Zone, another vector graphic classic from Atari. In the distance, a triangular volcano spewed green pixels of lava. You could run toward that volcano for days and never reach it. It always remained at the horizon. Just like in an old video game, the scenery never changed on Arcade, even if you circumnavigated the globe. Following my instructions, Max had set the Vonnegut down in a landing lot near the equator in the eastern hemisphere. The lot was empty, and the surrounding area appeared deserted. I headed toward the nearest green dot. As I approached, I could see that it was actually the mouth of an entrance tunnel, a neon green circle 10 meters in diameter, leading below ground. Arcade was a hollow planet, and the museum exhibits were all located beneath the surface. As I approached the nearest tunnel entrance, I heard loud music emanating from below. I recognized the song as "Pour Some Sugar on Me" by Def Leppard, off their Hysteria album. Epic Records, 1987. I reached the edge of the glowing green ring and jumped in. As my avatar plummeted down into the museum, the green vector graphic theme disappeared, and I found myself in high-resolution, full-color surroundings. Everything around me looked completely real once again. Below its surface, Arcade housed thousands of classic video arcades, each one a loving recreation of an actual arcade that had once existed somewhere in the real world. Since the dawn of the Oasis, thousands of elderly users had come here and painstakingly coded virtual replicas of local arcades they remembered from their childhood, thus making them a permanent part of the museum. And each of these simulated game rooms, bowling alleys, and pizza joints was lined with classic arcade games. There was at least one copy of every coin-operated video game ever made down here. The original game ROMs were all stored in the planet's Oasis code, and their wooden game cabinets were each coded to look like the antique originals. Hundreds of shrines and exhibits devoted to various game designers and publishers were also scattered throughout the museum. The museum's various levels were comprised of vast caverns linked by a network of subterranean streets, tunnels, staircases, elevators, escalators, ladders, slides, trapdoors, and secret passageways. It was like a massive underground multi-level labyrinth. The layout made it extremely easy to get lost, so I kept a three-dimensional holographic map on my display. My avatar's present location was indicated by a flashing blue dot. I'd entered the museum next to an old arcade called Aladdin's Castle, close to the surface. I touched a point on the map near the core of the planet, indicating my destination, and the software mapped the quickest route for me to get there. I ran forward, following it. The museum was divided into layers. Here, near the planet's mantle, you could find the last coin-operated video games ever made from the first few decades of the 21st century. These were mostly dedicated simulator cabinets with first-generation haptics, vibrating chairs, and tilting hydraulic platforms. Lots of networked stock car simulators that allowed people to race each other. These games were the last of their kind. By that era, home video game consoles had already made most coin-op games obsolete. After the Oasis went online, they stopped making them altogether. As you ventured deeper into the museum, the games grew older and more archaic. Turn-of-the-century coin-ops. Lots of head-to-head fighting games with blocky, polygon-rendered figures beating the crap out of each other on large, flat-screen monitors. Shooting games played with crude, haptic light guns. Dancing games. Once you reached the level below that, the games all began to look identical. Each was housed in a large, rectangular wooden box containing a cathode picture tube with a set of crude game controls mounted in front of it. You used your hands and your eyes, and occasionally your feet, to play these games. There were no haptics. These games didn't make you feel anything. And the deeper I descended, the cruder the game graphics got. The museum's bottom level, located in the planet core, was a spherical room containing a shrine to the very first video game, Tennis for Two, invented by William Higginbotham in 1958. The game ran on an ancient analog computer and was played on a tiny oscilloscope screen about 5 inches in diameter. Next to it was a replica of an ancient PDP-1 computer running a copy of Space War, the second video game ever made, created by a bunch of students at MIT in 1962. Like most Gunters, I'd visited Arcade a few times. I'd been to the core and had played both Tennis for Two and Space War until I'd mastered them. Then I'd wandered around the museum's many levels, playing games and looking for clues Halliday might have left behind, but I'd never found anything. I kept running, farther and farther down, until I reached the Gregarious Simulation Systems Museum, which was located just a few levels above the planet core. I'd been here once before, too, so I knew my way around. There were exhibits devoted to all of GSS's most popular games, including several arcade ports of titles they'd originally released for home computers and consoles. It didn't take me long to find the exhibit where Halliday's 5 Game Designer of the Year trophies were displayed, next to a bronze statue of the man himself. Within a few minutes, I knew I was wasting my time here. The GSS Museum exhibit was coded so that it was impossible to remove any of the items on display, so the trophies could not be collected. I spent a few minutes trying in vain to cut one of them free of its pedestal with a laser welding torch before calling it quits. Another dead end. This whole trip had been a waste of time. I took one last look around and headed for the exit, trying not to let my frustration get the best of me. I decided to take a different route on my way back up to the surface, through a section of the museum I'd never fully explored on my previous visits. I wandered through a series of tunnels that led me into a giant, cavernous chamber. It contained a kind of underground city, comprised entirely of pizza joints, bowling alleys, convenience stores, and, of course, video arcades. I wandered through the maze of empty streets, then down a winding back alley that dead-ended by the entrance of a small pizza shop. I froze in my tracks when I saw the name of the place. It was called Happy Time Pizza, and it was a replica of a small, family-run pizza joint that had existed in Halliday's hometown in the mid-1980s. Halliday appeared to have copied the code for Happy Time Pizza from his Middletown simulation and hidden a duplicate of it here in the Arcade Museum. What the hell was it doing here? I'd never seen its existence mentioned on any of the Gunter message boards or strategy guides. Was it possible no one had ever spotted it before now? Halliday mentioned Happy Time Pizza several times in the almanac, so I knew he had fond memories of this place. He'd often come here after school to avoid going home. The interior recreated the atmosphere of a classic 80s pizza parlor and video arcade in loving detail. Several NPC employees stood behind the counter, tossing dough and slicing pies. I turned on my olfactrix tower and discovered that I could actually smell the tomato sauce. The shop was divided into two halves, the game room and the dining room. The dining room had video games in it as well. All of the glass-top tables were actually sit-down arcade games known as cocktail cabinets. You could sit and play Donkey Kong on the table while you ate your pizza. If I'd been hungry, I could have ordered a real slice of pizza at the counter. The order would have been forwarded to a pizza vendor near my apartment complex, the one I'd specified in my Oasis account's food service preference settings. Then a slice would have been delivered to my door in a matter of minutes, and the cost, including tip, would have been deducted from my Oasis account balance. As I walked into the game room, I heard a Bryan Adams song blasting out of the speakers mounted on the carpeted walls. Bryan was singing about how, everywhere he went, the kids wanted to rock. I pressed my thumb to a plate on the change machine and bought a single quarter. I scooped it out of the stainless steel tray and headed to the back of the game room, taking in all of the simulation's little details. I spotted a handwritten note taped to the marquee of a Defender game. It read, "Beat the owner's high score and win a free large pizza." A Robotron game was currently displaying its high score list. Robotron allowed its all-time best player to enter an entire sentence of text beside their score instead of just their initials. And this machine's top dog had used his precious victory space to announce that Vice Principal Rundberg is a total douchebag. I continued farther into the dark electronic cave and walked up to a Pac-Man machine in the very back of the room, wedged between a Galaga and a Dig Dug. The black and yellow cabinet was covered with chips and scratches, and the garish side art was peeling. The Pac-Man game's monitor was dark, and there was an out-of-order sign taped to it. Why would Halliday include a broken game in this simulation? Was this just another atmospheric detail? Intrigued, I decided to investigate further. I pulled the game cabinet out from the wall and saw that the power cord was unplugged. I plugged it back into the wall socket and waited for the game to boot up. It seemed to work fine. As I was shoving the cabinet back into place, I spotted something. At the top of the game, resting on the metal brace that held the glass marquee in place, was a single quarter. The date on the coin was 1981, the year Pac-Man had been released. I knew that back in the 80s, placing your quarter on a game's marquee was how you reserved the next turn on the machine. But when I tried to remove the quarter, it wouldn't budge, like it was welded in place. Weird. I slapped the out-of-order sign on the neighboring Galaga cabinet and looked at the startup screen, which was listing off the game's villainous ghosts, Inky, Blinky, Pinky, and Clyde. The high score at the top of the screen was 3,333,350 points. Several things were strange about this. In the real world, Pac-Man machines didn't save their high score if they were unplugged, and the high score counter was supposed to flip over at 1 million points. But this machine displayed a high score of 3,333,350 points, just 10 points shy of the highest Pac-Man score possible. The only way to beat that score would be to play a perfect game. I felt my pulse quicken. I'd uncovered something here. Some sort of Easter egg hidden inside this old coin-op video game. It wasn't the Easter egg, just an Easter egg, some sort of challenge or puzzle, one I was almost certain had been created and placed here by Halliday. I didn't know if it had anything to do with the Jade Key. It might not be related to the egg at all. But there was only one way to find out. I would have to play a perfect game of Pac-Man. This was no easy feat. You had to play all 256 levels perfectly, all the way up to the final split screen. And you had to eat every single dot, energizer, fruit, and ghost possible along the way, without ever losing a single life. Less than 20 perfect games had been documented in the game's 60-year history. One of them, the fastest perfect game ever played, had been accomplished by James Halliday in just under 4 hours. He'd done it on an original Pac-Man machine located in the Gregarious Games break room. Because I knew Halliday loved the game, I'd already done a fair amount of research on Pac-Man, but I'd never managed to play a perfect game. Of course, I'd never really made a serious attempt. Up until now, I'd never had a reason to. I opened my Grail diary and pulled up all of the Pac-Man-related data I'd ever collected. The original game code, the unabridged biography of the designer Toru Iwatani, every Pac-Man strategy guide ever written, every episode of the Pac-Man cartoon series, the ingredients for Pac-Man cereal, and of course, patterns. I had Pac-Man pattern diagrams out the wazoo, along with hundreds of hours of archived video of the best Pac-Man players in history. I'd already studied a lot of this stuff, but I skimmed over it again now to refresh my memory. Then, I closed my Grail diary and studied the Pac-Man machine in front of me, like a gunfighter sizing up an opponent. I stretched my arms, rolled my head and neck around on my shoulders, and cracked my knuckles. When I dropped a quarter into the left coin slot, the game emitted a familiar electronic boop sound. I tapped the player one button, and the first maze appeared on the screen. I wrapped my right hand around the joystick and began to play, guiding my pizza-shaped protagonist through one maze after another. Waka 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 waka. My synthetic surroundings faded away as I focused on the game and lost myself in its ancient, two-dimensional reality. Just as with Dungeons of Daggerath, I was now playing a simulation within a simulation, a game within a game. I had several false starts. I would play for an hour or even two, then I'd make one tiny mistake and I'd have to reboot the machine and start all over. But I was now on my eighth attempt and I'd been playing for 6 hours straight. I was rocking like Dawkins. This game had been Iceman perfect so far. 255 screens in, and I still hadn't made a single mistake. I'd managed to nail all four ghosts with every single power pill until the 18th maze when they stopped turning blue altogether. And I'd snagged every bonus fruit, bird, bell, and key that had appeared without dying once. I was having the best game of my life. This was it. I could feel it. Everything was finally falling into place. I had the glow. There was a spot in each maze, just above the starting position, where it was possible to hide Pac-Man for up to 15 minutes. In that location, the ghosts couldn't find him. Using this trick, I'd been able to take two quick food and bathroom breaks during the past 6 hours. As I chomped my way through the 255th screen, the song Pac-Man Fever began to blast out of the game room stereo. A smile crept onto my face. I knew this had to be a small tip of the hat from Halliday. Sticking to my tried and true pattern one last time, I whipped the joystick right, slid into the secret door, then out the opposite side and straight down to snag the last few remaining dots, clearing the board. I took a deep breath as the outline of the blue maze began to pulse white, and then I saw it staring me in the face, the fabled split screen, the end of the game. Then, in the worst case of bad timing imaginable, a scoreboard alert flashed on my display just a few seconds after I began to play through the final screen. The top 10 rankings appeared, superimposed over my view of the Pac-Man screen, and I glanced at them just long enough to see that H had now become the second person to find the Jade Key. His score had just jumped 19,000 points, putting him in second place and knocking me into third. By some miracle, I managed not to flip out. I stayed focused on my Pac-Man game. I gripped the joystick tighter, refusing to let this wreck my concentration. I was nearly finished. I only had to milk the final 6,760 possible points from this last garbled maze, and then I would finally have the high score. My heart pounded in time with the music as I cleared the unblemished left half of the maze. Then I ventured into the twisted terrain of the right half, guiding Pac-Man through the pixelated on-screen refuse of the game's depleted memory. Hidden underneath all of those junk sprites and garbled graphics were 9 more dots worth 10 points each. I couldn't see them, but I had their locations memorized. I quickly found and ate all 9, gaining 90 more points. Then I turned and ran into the nearest ghost, Clyde, and committed Pac-icide, dying for the first time in the game. Pac-Man froze and withered into nothingness with an extended woo-woo-woo-woo-woo. Each time Pac-Man died on this final maze, the 9 hidden dots reappeared on the deformed right half of the screen. So to achieve the game's maximum possible score, I had to find and eat each of those dots 5 more times, once with each of my 5 remaining lives. I did my best not to think about H, who I knew must be holding the Jade Key at that very moment. Right now, he was probably reading whatever clue was etched into its surface. I pulled the joystick to the right, weaving through the digital debris one final time. I could have done it blindfolded by now. I fish-hooked around Pinky to grab the 2 dots near the bottom, then another 3 in the center, and then the last 4 near the top. I'd done it. I had the new high score. 3,333,360 points! A perfect game! I took my hands off the controls and watched as all 4 ghosts converged on Pac-Man. Game over flashed in the center of the maze. I waited. Nothing happened. After a few seconds, the game's attract screen came back up, showing the four ghosts, their names, and their nicknames. My gaze shot to the quarter sitting on the edge of the marquee brace. Earlier, it had been welded in place, unmovable, but now it tumbled forward and fell end over end, landing directly in the palm of my avatar's hand. Then it vanished, and a message flashed on my display informing me that the quarter had automatically been added to my inventory. When I tried to take it back out and examine it, I found that I couldn't. The quarter icon remained in my inventory. I couldn't take it out or drop it. If the quarter had any magical properties, they weren't revealed in its item description, which was completely empty. To learn anything more about the quarter, I would have to cast a series of high-level divination spells on it. That would take days and require a lot of expensive spell components, and even then, there was no guarantee the spells would tell me anything. But at the moment, I was having a hard time caring all that much about the mystery of the undroppable quarter. All I could think about was that H and Artemis had now both beaten me to the Jade Key, and getting the high score on this Pac-Man game on arcade obviously hadn't gotten me any closer to finding it myself. I really had been wasting my time here. I headed back up to the planet's surface. Just as I was sitting down in the Vonnegut's cockpit, an email from H arrived in my inbox. I felt my pulse quicken when I saw its subject line, "Payback time." Holding my breath, I opened the message and read it. "Dear Parzival, you and I are officially even now, got that? I consider my debt to you hereby paid in full. Better hurry, the Sixers must already be on their way there. Good luck, H." Below his signature was an image file he'd attached to the message. It was a high-resolution scan of the instruction manual cover for the text adventure game Zork, the version released in 1980 by Personal Software for the TRS-80 Model 3. I'd played and solved Zork once, a long time ago, back during the first year of the hunt. But I'd also played hundreds of other classic text adventure games that year, including all of Zork's sequels, and so most of the details of the game had now faded in my memory. Most old text adventure games were pretty self-explanatory, so I'd never actually bothered to read the Zork instruction manual. I now knew that this had been a colossal mistake. On the manual's cover was a painting depicting a scene from the game. A swashbuckling adventurer wearing armor and a winged helmet stood with a glowing blue sword raised over his head, preparing to strike a troll cowering before him. The adventurer clutched several treasures in his other hand, and more treasures lay at his feet, scattered among human bones. A dark, fanged creature lurked just behind the hero, glowering malevolently. All of this was in the painting's foreground, but my eyes had instantly locked on what was in the background. A large, white house with its front door and windows all boarded up. A dwelling long neglected. I stared at the image a few more seconds, just long enough to curse myself for not making the connection on my own months ago. Then I fired the Vonnegut's engines and set a course for another place in Sector 7, not far from Arcade. It was a small world called Froboz that was home to a detailed recreation of the game Zork. It was also, I now knew, the hiding place of the Jade Key. Chapter 23. Froboz was located in a group of several hundred rarely visited worlds known as the Zizzy Cluster. These planets all dated back to the early days of the Oasis, and each one recreated the environment of some classic text adventure game or MUD, multi-user dungeon. Each of these worlds was a kind of shrine, an interactive tribute to the Oasis's earliest ancestors. Text adventure games, often referred to as interactive fiction by modern scholars, used text to create the virtual environment the player inhabited. The game program provided you with a simple written description of your surroundings, then asked what you wanted to do next. To move around or interact with your virtual surroundings, you keyed in text commands telling the game what you wanted your avatar to do. These instructions had to be very simple, usually composed of just two or three words, such as go south or get sword. If a command was too complex, the game's simple parsing engine wouldn't be able to understand it. By reading and typing text, you made your way through the virtual world, collecting treasure, fighting monsters, avoiding traps, and solving puzzles until you finally reached the end of the game. The first text adventure game I'd ever played was called Colossal Cave, and initially, the text-only interface had seemed incredibly simple and crude to me. But after playing for a few minutes, I quickly became immersed in the reality created by the words on the screen. Somehow, the game's simple two-sentence room descriptions were able to conjure up vivid images in my mind's eye. Zork was one of the earliest and most famous text adventure games. According to my Grail diary, I'd played the game through to the end just once, all in one day, over 4 years ago. Since then, in a shocking display of unforgivable ignorance, I'd somehow forgotten two very important details about the game. 1. Zork began with your character standing outside a shuttered white house. 2. Inside the living room of that white house, there was a trophy case. To complete the game, every treasure you collected had to be returned to the living room and placed inside the trophy case. Finally, the rest of the quatrain made sense. The captain conceals the jade key in a dwelling long neglected, but you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected. Decades ago, Zork and its sequels had all been licensed and recreated inside the Oasis as stunning, three-dimensional immersive simulations, all located on the planet Froboz, which was named after a character in the Zork universe. So, the dwelling long neglected, the one I'd been trying to locate for the past 6 months, had been sitting right out in the open on Froboz this entire time, hiding in plain sight. I checked the ship's navigational computer. Traveling at light speed, it would take me just over 15 minutes to reach Froboz. There was a good chance the Sixers would beat me there. If they did, there would probably already be a small armada of Sixer gunships waiting in orbit around the planet when I dropped out of light speed. I would have to fight my way through them to reach the surface and then either lose them or try to find the jade key with them still breathing down my neck. Not a good scenario. Luckily, I had a backup plan, my ring of teleportation. It was one of the most valuable magic items in my inventory, looted from the horde of a red dragon I'd slain on Gygax. The ring allowed my avatar to teleport once a month to any location in the Oasis. I only used it in dire emergencies as a last-ditch means of escape or when I needed to get somewhere in a big hurry. Like right now. I quickly programmed the Vonnegut's onboard computer to autopilot the ship to Froboz. I instructed it to activate its cloaking device as soon as it dropped out of hyperspace, then locate me on the planet's surface and land somewhere nearby. If I was lucky, the Sixers wouldn't detect my ship and blast it out of the sky before it could reach me. If they did, I'd be stuck on Froboz with no way to leave while the entire Sixer army closed in on me. I engaged the Vonnegut's autopilot, then activated my ring of teleportation by speaking the command word, Brundle. When the ring began to glow, I said the name of the planet where I wished to teleport. A world map of Froboz appeared on my display. It was a large world, and like the planet Middletown, its surface was covered with hundreds of identical copies of the same simulation. In this case, recreations of the Zork playing field. There were 512 copies of it, to be exact, which meant there were 512 white houses spaced out evenly across the planet's surface. I should be able to obtain the jade key at any one of them, so I selected one of the copies at random on the map. My ring emitted a blinding flash of light, and a split second later my avatar was there, standing on the surface of Froboz. I opened my Grail diary and located my original notes on how to solve Zork. Then, I pulled up a map of the game's playing field and placed it in the corner of my display. Surveying the skies, I didn't see any sign of the Sixers, but that didn't mean they hadn't already arrived. Sorrento and his underlings had probably just teleported to one of the other playing fields. Everybody knew that the Sixers had already been camped out in Sector 7, waiting for this moment. As soon as they saw H's score increase, they would have used Findoro's Tablet of Finding and learned that he was currently on Froboz, which meant the entire Sixer Armada would already be on its way here. So I needed to get to the key as quickly as possible, then get the hell out of Dodge. I took a look around. My surroundings were eerily familiar. The opening text description in the game Zork read as follows. West of house. You are standing in an open field west of a white house with a boarded front door. There is a small mailbox here. My avatar now stood in that open field, just west of the White House. The front door of the old Victorian mansion was boarded up, and there was a mailbox just a few yards away from me at the end of the walkway leading to the house. The house was surrounded by a dense forest, and beyond it I saw a range of jagged mountain peaks. Glancing off to my left, I spotted a path leading to the north, right where I knew it should be. I ran around the back of the house. I found a small window there, slightly ajar, and I forced it open and climbed inside. As I expected, I found myself in the kitchen. A wooden table sat in the center of the room, and on it rested a long brown sack and a bottle of water. A chimney stood nearby, and a staircase led up to the attic. A hallway off to my left led to the living room, just like the game. But the kitchen also contained things that weren't mentioned in the game's text description of this room. A stove, a refrigerator, several wooden chairs, a sink, and a few rows of kitchen cabinets. I opened the fridge. It was full of junk food. Fossilized pizza, snack puddings, lunch meat, and a wide array of condiment packets. I checked the cupboards. They were filled with canned and dry goods, rice, pasta, soup, and cereal. One entire cupboard was crammed with boxes of vintage breakfast cereals, most of which had been discontinued before I'd been born. Fruit Loops, Honeycombs, Lucky Charms, Count Chocula, Quisp, Frosted Flakes. And hidden way at the back was a lone box of Cap'n Crunch. Printed clearly on the front of it were the words, "Free toy whistle inside." The captain conceals the jade key. I dumped the contents of the box out on the counter, scattering golden cereal nuggets everywhere. Then I spotted it, a small plastic whistle encased in a clear cellophane envelope. I tore off the cellophane and held the whistle in my hand. It was yellow in color, with the cartoon face of Cap'n Crunch molded on one side and a small dog on the other. The words "Cap'n Crunch Bosun Whistle" were embossed on either side. I raised the whistle to my avatar's lips and blew into it, but the whistle emitted no sound and nothing happened. You can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected. I pocketed the whistle and opened the sack on the kitchen table. I saw a clove of garlic inside, and I added it to my inventory. Then I ran west into the living room. The floor was covered with a large oriental rug. Antique furniture, the kind I'd seen in films from the 1940s, was positioned around the room. A wooden door with odd characters carved into its surface was set into the west wall. And against the opposite wall, there was a beautiful glass trophy case. It was empty. A battery-powered lantern sat on top of the case, and a shining sword was mounted on the wall directly above it. I took the sword and the lantern, then rolled up the oriental rug, uncovering the trap door I already knew was hidden underneath. I opened it, revealing a staircase that led down into a darkened cellar. I turned on the lamp. As I descended the staircase, my sword began to glow. I continued to refer to the Zork notes in my Grail diary, which reminded me exactly how to make my way through the game's labyrinth of rooms, passageways, and puzzles. I collected all 19 of the game's treasures as I went, returning repeatedly to the living room in the White House to place them in the trophy case a few at a time. Along the way, I had to do battle with several NPCs, a troll, a cyclops, and a really annoying thief. As for the legendary Gru, lurking in the dark, waiting to dine on my flesh, I simply avoided him. Aside from the Cap'n Crunch whistle hidden in the kitchen, I found no surprises or deviations from the original game. To solve this immersive, three-dimensional version of Zork, I simply had to perform the exact same actions required to solve the original text-based game. By running at top speed and by never stopping to sightsee or second-guess myself, I managed to complete the game in 22 minutes. Shortly after I collected the last of the game's 19 treasures, a tiny brass bauble, a notice flashed in my display informing me that the Vonnegut had arrived outside. The autopilot had just landed the ship in the field to the west of the White House. Its cloaking device was still engaged, and its shields were up. If the Sixers were already here, in orbit around the planet, I was hoping they hadn't spotted my ship. I ran back to the living room of the White House one last time and placed the final treasure inside the trophy case. Just as in the original game, a map appeared inside the case, directing me to a hidden barrow that marked the end of the game. But I wasn't concerned with the map or with finishing the game. All of the trophies were now collected in the case. So I took out the Cap'n Crunch whistle. It had three holes across the top, and I covered the third one to generate the 2600 hertz tone that had made this whistle famous in the annals of hacker history. Then I blew one clear, shrill note. The whistle transformed into a small key, and my score on the scoreboard increased by 18,000 points. I was back in second place, a mere 1,000 points ahead of H. A second later, the entire Zork simulation reset itself. The 19 items in the trophy case vanished, returning to their original locations, and the rest of the house and the game's playing field returned to the same state in which I'd found them. As I stared at the key in the palm of my hand, I felt a brief jolt of panic. The key was silver, not the milky green color of jade. But when I turned the key over and examined it more closely, I saw that it actually appeared to be wrapped in silver foil, like a stick of gum or a bar of chocolate. I carefully peeled the wrapper away, and a key made of polished green stone was revealed inside. The Jade Key. And, just like the copper key, I saw that it had a clue etched into its surface. Continue your quest by taking the test. I reread it several times, but I had no immediate revelations as to its meaning, so I placed the key in my inventory, then examined the wrapper. It was silver foil on one side and white paper on the other. I didn't see any markings on either side. Just then, I heard the muffled roar of approaching spacecraft and knew it must be the Sixers. It sounded like they were here in force. I pocketed the wrapper and ran out of the house. Overhead, thousands of Sixer gunships filled the sky like an angry swarm of metal wasps. The ships were separating into small groups as they descended, heading off in different directions as if to blanket the entire surface of the planet. I didn't think the Sixers would be foolish enough to try to barricade all 512 instances of the White House. That strategy had worked for them on Ludus, but only for a few hours, and they'd only had one location to barricade. The entire planet of Froboz was in a PvP zone, and both magic and technology functioned here, which meant that all bets were off. There would be hordes of Gunters arriving here soon, armed to the teeth, and if the Sixers tried to keep all of them at bay, it would mean war on a scale never before seen in the history of the Oasis. As I continued running across the field and up the ramp of my ship, I spotted a large squadron of gunships, about 100 or so, descending from the sky directly above my location. They appeared to be headed straight for me. Max had already powered up the Vonnegut's engines, so I shouted for him to lift off as soon as I was aboard. When I reached the cockpit controls, I threw the throttle wide open, and the descending swarm of Sixer gunships banked hard to follow me. As my ship blasted its way skyward, I began to take heavy fire from several directions, but I was lucky. My ship was fast, and my shields were top of the line, so they managed to hold up long enough for me to reach orbit. But they failed a few seconds later, and the Vonnegut's hull suffered an alarming amount of damage in the handful of seconds it took me to make the jump to light speed. It was a close call. The bastards almost got me. My ship was in bad shape, so instead of returning directly to my stronghold, I headed to Joe's Garage, an orbital starship repair shop over in Sector 10. Joe's was an honest NPC-operated establishment with reasonable rates and lightning-fast service. I used them whenever the Vonnegut needed repairs or upgrades. While Joe and his boys worked on my ship, I sent H a brief email to say thanks. I told him that whatever debt he felt he owed me was now most definitely paid in full. I also copped to being a colossally insensitive, self-centered asshole and begged him to forgive me. As soon as the repairs to my ship were finished, I headed back to my stronghold. Then, I spent the rest of the day glued to the news feeds. The word about Froboz was out, and every gunter with the means had already teleported there. Thousands of others were arriving by spacecraft every minute to do battle with the Sixers and secure their own copy of the Jade Key. The news feeds were airing live coverage of the hundreds of large-scale battles breaking out on Froboz around nearly every instance of the Dwelling Long Neglected. The big Gunter clans had once again banded together to launch a coordinated attack on the Sixers' forces. It was the beginning of what would come to be known as the Battle of Froboz, and casualties were already mounting on both sides. I also kept a close eye on the scoreboard, waiting to see evidence that the Sixers had begun to collect copies of the Jade Key while their forces held the opposition at bay. As I feared, the next score to increase was the one beside Sorrento's IOI employee number. It jumped 17,000 points, moving him into fourth place. Now that the Sixers knew exactly where and how to obtain the Jade Key, I expected to see their other avatars' scores begin to jump as Sorrento's underlings followed his lead. But to my surprise, the next avatar to snag the Jade Key was none other than Shoto. He did it less than 20 minutes after Sorrento. Somehow, Shoto had managed to evade the hordes of Sixers currently swarming all over the planet. Enter an instance of the White House, collect all 19 of the required treasures, and obtain his copy of the key. I continued to watch the scoreboard, expecting to see his brother Daito's score increase as well, but that never happened. Instead, a few minutes after Shoto obtained his copy of the key, Daito's name disappeared from the scoreboard entirely. There was only one possible explanation. Daito had just been killed. Chapter 24. Over the next 12 hours, chaos continued to reign on Froboz as every gunter in the oasis scrambled to reach the planet and join the fray. The Sixers had dispersed their grand army across the globe in a bold attempt to blockade all 512 copies of the Zork playing field. But their forces, as vast and well-equipped as they were spread far too thin this time. Only 7 more of their avatars managed to obtain the Jade Key that day. And when the Gunter clans began their coordinated attack on the Sixers' forces, the boobs in blue began to suffer heavy casualties and were forced to pull back. Within a matter of hours, the Sixer High Command decided to deploy a new strategy. It had quickly become obvious that they wouldn't be able to maintain over 500 different blockades or fend off the massive influx of gunters. So they regrouped all of their forces around 10 adjacent instances of the Zork playing field near the planet's south pole. They installed powerful force shields over each of them and stationed armored battalions outside the shield walls. This scaled-down strategy worked, and the Sixers' forces proved sufficient to hold those 10 locations and prevent any other Gunters from getting inside. And there wasn't much reason for other Gunters to try, since over 500 other instances of Zork now stood wide open and unprotected. Now that the Sixers could operate undisturbed, they basically formed 10 lines of avatars outside each White House and began to run them through the process of obtaining the Jade Key, one after another. Everyone could plainly see what they were doing because the digits beside each IOI employee number on the scoreboard began to increase by 15,000 points. At the same time, hundreds of Gunter scores were increasing as well. Now that the location of the Jade Key was public knowledge, deciphering the quatrain and figuring out how to obtain the key was relatively easy. It was there for the taking to anyone who had already cleared the first gate. As the Battle of Froboz drew to a close, the rankings on the scoreboard stood like this. High scores. Number 1, Artemis, 129,000. Number 2, Parzival, 128,000. Number 3, H, 127,000. Number 4, IOI 655321, 122,000. Number 5, Shoto, 122,000. Number 6, IOI 643187, 120,000. Number 7, IOI 621671, 120,000. Number 8, IOI 678324, 120,000. Number 9, IOI 637330, 120,000. Number 10, IOI 699423, 120,000. Even though Shoto had matched Sorrento's score of 122,000 points, Sorrento had achieved that score first, which must be the reason he'd remained in the higher slot. The relatively small point bonuses Artemis, H, Shoto, and I had received for being the first to reach the Copper and Jade Keys were what kept our names in the hallowed High Five slots. Sorrento had now earned one of these bonuses too. Seeing his IOI employee number above Shoto's name made me cringe. Scrolling down, I saw that the scoreboard was now over 5,000 names long, with more being added every hour as new avatars finally managed to defeat a Sararak at Joust and collect their own instance of the Copper Key. No one on the message board seemed to know what had happened to Diato, but the common assumption was that he'd been killed by the Sixers during the first few minutes of the Battle of Froboz. Rumors about exactly how he had died were running rampant, but no one had actually been witness to his demise, except for maybe Shoto, and he'd vanished. I'd sent him a few chat requests, but got no reply. Like me, I assumed he was focusing all of his energy on finding the second gate before the Sixers did. I sat in my stronghold, staring at the Jade Key, and reciting the words etched into its spine over and over like a maddening mantra. Continue your quest by taking the test. Continue your quest by taking the test. Continue your quest by taking the test. Yes, but what test? What test was I supposed to take? The Kobayashi Maru? The Pepsi Challenge? Could the clue have been any more vague? I reached under my visor and rubbed my eyes in frustration. I decided I needed to take a break and get some sleep. I pulled up my avatar's inventory and placed the Jade Key back inside. As I did, I noticed the silver foil wrapper in the inventory slot beside it, the wrapper that had covered the Jade Key when it first appeared in my hand. I knew the secret to deciphering the riddle must involve the wrapper in some way, but I still couldn't sort out how. I wondered if it might be a reference to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, but then decided against it. There hadn't been any golden ticket inside the wrapper. It must have some other purpose or meaning. I stared at the wrapper and pondered this until I could no longer keep my eyes open. Then I logged out and went to sleep. A few hours later, at 6:12 a.m. OST, I was jolted awake by the gut-wrenching sound of my scoreboard alarm alerting me that one of the top rankings had changed again. Filled with a growing sense of dread, I logged in and pulled up the scoreboard, unsure of what to expect. Maybe Artemis had finally cleared Gate 2? Or perhaps H or Shoto had achieved that honor? But all of their scores remained unchanged. To my horror, I saw that it was Sorrento's score that had increased by 200,000 points, and two gate icons now appeared beside it. Sorrento had just become the first person to find and clear the second gate. As a result, his avatar now stood in first place at the top of the scoreboard. I sat there, frozen, staring at Sorrento's employee number, silently weighing the repercussions of what had just happened. Upon exiting the gate, Sorrento would have been given a clue as to the location of the crystal key, the key that would open the third and final gate. So now, the Sixers were the only ones who possessed that clue, which meant they were now closer to finding Halliday's Easter egg than anyone had ever been. I suddenly felt ill, and I was also having a difficult time breathing. I realized I must be having some sort of panic attack. A total and complete freakout, a massive mental meltdown, whatever you want to call it. I went a little nuts. I tried calling H, but he didn't pick up. Either he was still pissed off at me, or he had other, more pressing matters to attend to. I was about to call Shoto, but then I remembered that his brother's avatar had just been killed. He probably wasn't in a very receptive mood. I considered flying to Benatar to try to get Artemis to talk to me, but then I came to my senses. She'd had the jade key in her possession for several days, and she still hadn't been able to clear the second gate. Learning that the Sixers had done it in less than 24 hours had probably driven her into a psychotic rage, or maybe a catatonic stupor. She probably didn't feel like talking to anyone right now, least of all me. I tried calling her anyway. As usual, she didn't answer. I was so desperate to hear a familiar voice that I resorted to talking to Max. In my current state, even his glib, computer-generated voice was somehow comforting. Of course, it didn't take long for Max to run out of pre-programmed replies, and when he started to repeat himself, the illusion that I was talking to another person was shattered, and I felt even more alone. You know you've totally screwed up your life when your whole world turns to shit and the only person you have to talk to is your system agent software. I couldn't go back to sleep, so I stayed up watching the news feeds and scanning the Gunter message boards. The Sixer Armada remained on Froboz, and their avatars were still farming copies of the Jade Key. Sorrento had obviously learned from his previous mistake. Now that the Sixers alone knew the location of the second gate, they weren't going to be stupid enough to reveal its location to the world by trying to barricade it with their armada. But they were still taking full advantage of the situation. As the day progressed, the Sixers continued to walk additional avatars through the second gate. After Sorrento made it through, another 10 Sixers cleared it during the following 24 hours. As each Sixer score increased by 200,000 points, Artemis, H, Shoto, and I were all pushed farther and farther down the scoreboard until we'd been knocked out of the top 10 entirely, and the scoreboard's main page displayed nothing but IOI employee numbers. The Sixers now ruled the roost. Then, when I was sure things couldn't possibly get any worse, they did. They got much, much worse. 2 days after he cleared the second gate, Sorrento's score jumped another 30,000 points, indicating that he had just acquired the crystal key. I sat there in my stronghold, staring at the monitors, watching all of this unfold in stunned horror. There was no denying it. The end of the contest was at hand, and it wasn't going to end like I'd always thought it would, with some noble, worthy Gunter finding the egg and winning the prize. I'd been kidding myself for the past 5.5 years. We all had. This story was not going to have a happy ending.